Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. It's bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it's Friday, but you're going to hear this on Saturday. And our guest is... Introduce yourself, guest.
I'm Alden Lowry. I'm the senior editor of the Race, Class, and Communities desk at WBEZ. And I'm 5'6¾". I'm born and raised in Chicago on the South Side. A little time in public housing as a kid, but the Auburn Gresham neighborhood for the rest of my childhood. Love the job that I do. Love the work that I've been involved in as a journalist here in Chicago, examining, writing, and hopefully educating people about the issues of race and class and inequality in Chicago, how it's part of our core as a city. It's so deep in terms of our history and our legacy, and it's still a part of kind of who we are today. And so my hope is the work that I've done wherever I've been, from the Chicago Reporter to the BGA to the Metropolitan Planning Council and now with WBEZ, that will be kind of the thread that that people will hopefully kind of grab onto in the work that comes out of it.
Alden, I forgot the PGA. I forgot. In my mind, Alden Lowry is, first of all, this is how I would do it. Number one, a graduate of Whitney Young. And number two, a Chicago Reporter alum, because yes. Many years ago I worked at the Chicago, way before Alden, I worked at the Chicago Reporter. And number three, Metropolitan Planning Council, because when I had my other existence as a radio show talk host, what was the name of that station, D?
WCUR Fire.
Yeah, WCUR Fire. Beat it! Anyway, Alden was a regular monthly guest on my show. We talked about demographic issues and where you get to those, but I just want to point out to our listeners, this show is generally videotaped and you can see it on YouTube, but the bonus specials aren't. For the second week in a row, my bonus guest and I are wearing the same colored shirt.
Some kind of subliminal mess, some kind of mental telepathy or something you got going.
This interview on the Ben Jarofsky Show is brought to you by The Color Purple.
We're both wearing purple. Last week, Henry Davis and I, we were both wearing red.
Red polos. Looks red like you guys polos. Got out of a Target training.
By the way, I want to urge everybody, yourself included, Alden, if you haven't already, check out the interview with Henry Davis. I'm just going to plug it one more time. And he is a councilman, that's what they call him, in South Bend, Indiana, which is the city where Mayor Pete yeah. Represents. And Henry ran against Mayor Pete for mayor in 2015. And if you want a different perspective on Mayor Pete than the sort of glowing perspectives that you'll get, you might want to listen to that interview with Henry Davis, who by coincidence happens to be the younger brother of Stacey Davis Gates, who is one of the leaders of the Chicago Teacher Union. Anyway, Henry and I were wearing the same colored shirt, and now I am wearing the same colored shirt with Alden Lowry. All right, so it cannot be an Alden Lowry interview, and I don't care if he's working for the Reporter or the Metropolitan Planning Council or WBEZ, where you are now currently working, Alden, without me asking you about demographics. It's an obsession that I have, and I think you share it a little bit.
I do.
And essentially, we're talking about the changes that have occurred in our lifetime in the city of Chicago, population changes, black people moving out, white people moving in, which is a complete reverse of everything that was going on when I first moved to Chicago and in the 70s or in the 80s. And we've always struggled, you and I, to try to figure out what's going on and why it's going on. But I'm going to give you some numbers that I was telling you about before that I got from a Sarah Karp article, the legendary, the great Sarah Karp, education reporter for BEZ. And she noted when Mayor Rahm took office in May of 2011. Follow me in this.
Okay.
There were approximately 404,000 students in the Chicago public schools. So 404,000 students in the Chicago public schools. When Mayor Rahm left office just a few weeks ago, there were 361,000 students in the Chicago public schools. So the number of students in the Chicago public schools fell by, almost 45,000. There were 45,000 fewer students in the schools when Rahm left than from when there were when he got in. And of that, the racial breakdown, in 2011, it was 42% black. In 2019, it's now 37% black. It was 9% white in 2011, and it is now 10.5% white. So I believe, though, and the Hispanic population has roughly stayed the same, at least in terms of the overall percentage.
Yeah.
So, Alden, it sure sounds to me when I look at those numbers that everything that you've been talking about with me over these years is holding true, that the city in the last decade or so, black people moving out and white people are either moving in or just staying stable enough that they're rising as a proportion of the total.
Yeah, the numbers, the white population figures actually have been growing, and they've been growing actually faster in volume, overall numbers, than any other group. As a percentage basis, they are second to Asians. The Asian population has actually been growing at a faster rate from a percentage standpoint, but Asians are roughly, I think, maybe 6% of the city's population, so they're a much smaller group. Whites are about 30%, a little over 30% of the city's overall population. The schools are a very interesting thing, because think about those numbers, 10.5%, and then I just gave you this 30, 31%, 32% number for the overall population. So even though the white population is growing, they are still, as a group, very underrepresented in Chicago public schools. And as you might imagine, that doesn't mean that white kids aren't going to school. It's just that they're not going to public schools at the same clip that that other racial groups are attending a public school in Chicago. And if you look at a number of places that have gentrified and have their percentage of their population has become more white over the years, I'm thinking explicitly of places like Washington, D.C., the change in terms of which was known in the 90s as a chocolate city, and
George Clinton,
and because it was African Americans, if they weren't the majority, they were certainly the plurality in DC, and so that's certainly changed in a way that's, I think, even a little more dramatic than what Chicago is seeing. But the white population within the schools in D.C. was very similar to what it's here in Chicago. I think it's maybe around 14% now. But over the last, I would say, maybe 5 to 10 years, that number has crept up from around maybe 10 or 11% to about 14%. So it's a slow climb. But D.C. is one of the few places, and I took a look at these numbers some months ago just out of curiosity, D.C. is one of the few places that's actually seeing a fairly sharp increase in terms of its public school population for white students. And Chicago is, even though that percentage has come up, if you actually look at the number of white kids in CPS, the number is only up a very small amount. Yeah. It's just that the numbers for African Americans in particular, but even Latinos, the last 3 or 4 years, the volume, the actual number of Latino students in CPS has actually come down a little bit each year. Mm-hmm. And when the African American population in CPS has actually been dropping since the 90s, but it had been offset in terms of the total number of students in CPS because the Latino population was growing, but now the Latino population is declining as well. And so the 45,000 or so drop in overall students in CPS during Rahm's tenure includes a decline to some degree, at least during the second term, of Latino students, which is troubling. But the number of white students and the number of Asian students isn't going up dramatically to offset that. And the system overall may not be white enough, or there may not be enough schools that are white enough to really And I'll just say it to give a lot of white parents the confidence to send their kids to public school.
Yeah, and you're getting at something that's really crucial when it comes to city planning, whether people admit it or not. And that is this sort of psychological barrier. And what else? A tipping point, I think, is what they call it, Alden, where if the number of black kids in a public school crosses a certain threshold, then there will be a dramatic plummet in the number of white kids as white parents make the decision, this school's getting a little iffy for me. I want to get out of here. And but I wonder if the demographic studies show that the reverse is true. Follow me in this, that if the number of black kids falls, white parents go, I hear this school's getting better. I hear this school's really getting better. I think I'll send a little Johnny there. Mm-hmm. Is that trend also prevalent?
You know, I don't know. I mean, my hunch would be that that number would have to fall quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But as I say that, one thing that I did look at during my time at MPC was looking at the selective enrollment high schools. And so which I think is a fascinating subject. So the elite of the 11 selective enrollment schools, we're talking about Young, we're talking about Peyton, Northside College Prep, Jones, and Lane Tech. Mm-hmm. And that's not to diminish the other six selective enrollment schools. My middle daughter goes to Brooks, which is a great school on the far south side. But there's some other great schools, Lindblom. There's also Westinghouse, which has really become one of the better schools in the city. There's also South Shore, Lindblom, or did I mention Lindblom
King.
Already? King is one. And then there's the school on the southwest side.
Hancock.
Thank you. So all really good schools in their own right. But among those elite schools, the African-American population has declined. And the white population has gone up, particularly in places like Young, in Jones, and in Peyton. Northside College Prep, I think, from its inception right around 2000, has always had a very a strong white representation among its student body, as has Lane. But those other three schools were much more of a real kind of mix that mirrored the city of Chicago, in terms of right around the turn of the millennium, actually, right around 2000. Young, Peyton, when it first started, and Jones, when it became a selective enrollment school, which was a couple years later, I believe 2, 3, 4 years later after Peyton and Northside College Prep came into existence. But their student bodies were very mixed. But the African-American population at Jones and at Peyton has dipped below 20%. At Young, it's in the low 20% now. And African-Americans, who were the largest group at Young and were a much larger group than any other student body or student group when I was there, umpteen million years ago.
Come on, you even...
I graduated in 87, so it's been whoa, over 30. It's been over 30 years. Yeah,
you're still a lot younger than I am.
Oh well. that helps me feel a little better.
Okay.
I mean, Young felt like a black school when I was there, and I want to say African Americans were roughly about 50% of the population. And at that time, I could be wrong about this, but when I was in high school, my understanding was that Young was meant to mirror the demographics of the city in terms of CPS, not the city, but in terms of CPS. And at that time, African Americans were roughly about half of the CPS student body. Now, the selective enrollment schools, because Young wasn't even considered quote unquote selective enrollment, it was a magnet school. So the policies have changed a great deal, but even into the 90s, African Americans were still kind of the major group at Young, and now they're the third largest group.
So it's 22% black right now at Whitney Young?
I'm not sure the exact number, but it's less than 25%.
Wow, okay, so here's, there's a reverse question.
So to your point, those are schools, at least those three schools in particular, the African-American population is declining. The white population is increasing in those schools. But I would say there's probably, and I almost have to hold my tongue when I say this, because I was going to say there's a lot more kind of going into that. But there is the potential that is something that may make those schools a little more interesting for white parents than perhaps thinking about Lane and Northside College Prep, where the white population has always been much more robust. You got Jones, which is also located in, you know, the heart of the city, as is Peyton, and to tell you the truth, as is Young. Young's not terribly far. It's in the West Loop. And so that part of the city is growing. And the white, when we talk about white population growth in the city of Chicago, the epicenter of that growth is in and around downtown. Mm-hmm. And in some respects, maybe Lincoln Park, Lakeview, places like that, which are also growing. Lakeview is now the, if I'm not mistaken, is the largest by population community area in the city of Chicago, surpassing Austin, who had held that distinction for decades, primarily because Austin is just a huge space geographically, but it has dipped below Lakeview in terms of overall population. But that's where a lot of that white population growth is occurring, and so those schools may be attractive also because they're centrally located. And that's where people, a lot of white folks, a lot of white folks are living.
All right. And I openly admit this. I'm almost embarrassing to admit that. I think I'm the only person in the city of Chicago, white or black, who thinks that integration is a goal that our government should be encouraging as much as possible. So as such, I believe in what they call a quota system for these special enrollment kids. I realize all that. I admit this up front. I am totally alone in this issue. I'm not afraid to be alone in an issue.
I wouldn't say you're alone there. I think there are a number of people who believe that.
I'll put it to you this way. As a policy implemented by the city of Chicago, it was abandoned years ago. I remember when Paul Vallis said that spending money on busing is a waste of money. And the reason we had busing in Chicago was to voluntarily integrate the schools. And the only way you could do it is if you move a kid out of a segregated neighborhood into a neighborhood that where they would encounter children of other races. Yeah. And so Vallis said that was a waste of money. And we ever since then, we've been abandoning the goal of integration. And so as a result, I think you're seeing that. Well, I think we see it citywide. With these larger demographic trends, but we're seeing that as well with the schools.
Yeah, the schools are. I mean, there's an aspect of the schools that is essentially an outgrowth of the way we live in terms of the segregation of our communities, particularly with neighborhood attendance area schools. But for these selective enrollment schools or other schools that draw from students citywide, you would think that those would be places where we would see much more. And to their credit, those are the most diverse or integrated schools in the city. Even Northside College Prep and Lane still have much more integration than many of our communities. But what we're also seeing is that Lane, Northside College Prep, Young, Peyton, and Jones are all Central City or Northside schools, and the other six selective enrollment schools are either on the west side, the south side, or the southwest side. And those schools are largely African-American, with the exception of Hancock, which is largely Latino. And so those schools, even though they are among the best high schools in the city, mm-hmm. are deeply segregated. And so when I think about selective enrollments, I think I have a concern about the declining number of black students in those elite schools. But I think it's also equally interesting that there's very little interest in folks who are not black or Latino going to those other schools. And like I said, Westinghouse, particularly Westinghouse, Brooks, and Lindblom, and Hancock also, which tests very well. Those are some really good schools. Yeah. And so if you live on the southeast side or the far southwest side, if you're on the southeast side, so you're in Hegwisch or somewhere out there, Brooks should be a place that you're interested in sending your kid to school. Yeah. If you're living in Mount Greenwood, Hancock might actually be a closer school to you, or Lindblom might actually be a school that should be of interest to you. But there aren't very many white kids from Mount Greenwood that are going to Lindblom or to Hancock. Yeah. And so I think that's something that is, you know, they'd rather probably send their kid to a private school that's out in their area. But I think that's also a part of this whole struggle that we have as a city with race, that we don't give enough time and attention.
Yes. And I should add that part of the reason why their we have abandoned busing as a way to integrate is that the consent decree that mandated that the city of Chicago have integration as a goal is no longer exists, so the city's free to be as segregated as the city wants to be, and apparently city loves segregation because we do a good job of it. You said something to me in an interview, I forget, it was about a year ago, and we were talking about demographics, and you were talking about the decline of the black population in the city of Chicago, as we just, it's evidenced by these numbers in the public schools. And I said to you, I'm doing this from memory, my goodness, that why didn't people in positions of power do something about this? And I'm paraphrasing you, Alden, but you said, Ben, I'm not sure the people saw it as a problem. And it was, I quote you all the time. I give you credit. I just steal your quotes, Alden. You'd be happy to know.
Well, you probably spice them up with a occasional. not that I'm not that I'm averse to being profane at times, but Ben, you're much better at it.
By the way, you are. The difference between having a podcast and a radio show, you're allowed to curse. So if it slips out, it slips out.
Oh, great.
All right. So I just got finished saying how it's people who run the public school systems don't see it as a problem. And you're absolutely correct. There's no reason to where white parents on the south side of Chicago, and there are a lot of white parents on the south side of Chicago, don't send their kid to Brooks. You know what I'm saying? It's a great school.
It's a great, school.
Beautiful facility. It used to be Mendel High School.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And Lindblom, those two girls that were in the front page of the Sun-Times as twins, they're going to Northwestern and Duke. Hey, white parents, your kid can go to Northwestern and Duke, okay? Yeah. So these are great schools, smart kids, you know? But there's clearly this mental block that exists on the part of parents. Now, is there a mental block, in your humble opinion, among black parents who don't want to send their kid to a school that's too white, too many white people? They'll think that there'd be prejudice against their kid.
I think there certainly is a concern, and I'll even make it personal. My oldest daughter went to Jones, and she loved it. She had a great experience there as a student. Socially, she experienced some struggles there, and not from the standpoint of kids doing incredibly insensitive things, but she experienced this also when she was in college, which I think a lot of African Americans shared the same experience who went to predominantly white institutions, that there is, as there is in society, there are challenges that we have around racial differences. We see the world differently. We think about political issues differently. We've had different life experiences. We don't often know how really to kind of coexist and to kind of share the same space, to relinquish the stage, to allow other voices to have their say. And so she experienced that at Jones. She helped restart kind of a black student group there at Jones. They would hold programs. And, she's a bit of a spark plug. So, they were doing programming to talk about the challenges of being a student group that was maybe 15-16% of the population there at Jones, and having to struggle with instances where people would say or do insensitive things, sometimes being challenged, their intellect perhaps being challenged by teachers there, feeling that they always had to kind of prove their worth and their value and why they were in one of the best schools in the city, and not just from their fellow students, but even from people who were instructing them. And when they wanted to talk about those things, there was often, so not only are they experiencing that from time to time, but then when they talk about it, they were kind of getting, or people were trying to shut them down, or were not allowing them and respecting that this was the experience that they were having. And so as much as she wanted to stand up and talk about this and to organize around it, and she did, it was dismaying to kind of have to be in that environment and to have the kind of pushback that she experienced, and to some degree she experienced that also when she was in college. So I think those are real life challenges for African Americans in a variety of walks of life. I've experienced that in my own professional life as well. I think about every job I've had, literally, either in the institution as a whole or in the immediate team that I worked with. I was the only black male on staff at each of the last four or five journalism positions that I've had. And there are certainly times when I've felt isolated, and at least I've had to question whether or not I am being, you know, kind of honored and respected and valued in that space, particularly when there are moments of conflict. And so, yeah, as a parent, when you think about putting your child out in the world and you're sending them to a space where there aren't very many people who look like them, particularly if it is considered an elite institution, that's got to be something where people will say, you know what, maybe I'd rather send my kid to this really good school where that looks like Brooks, or it looks like Lynn Bloom, or looks like Westinghouse. And when I presented the numbers to CPS about as kind of the growing racial kind of stratification within the selective enrollment community of CPS high schools, that was one of the things that they pointed to. Well, you know, a lot of black families are just deciding not to send their kids to Young. They're sending them to Brooks. And so what's the problem there?
I like the accent. That
That's all for me.
That was really good.
So there may very well be a thread of truth there. I was raising the question about, is there something happening within those other selective enrollment schools that perhaps is more difficult for students to get in, but also the, you know, presenting the point that maybe this isn't a great thing that you've got the numbers diminishing the way they were. But yeah, I think that's certainly something that that black parents think about. And just, I would say, socially, I have sensed there are a number of black parents now who are kind of in my age group, who, you know, are sending their kids to college now, who are very high on the notion of HBCUs, even if they didn't attend an HBCU themselves.
Historically black.
Black, yeah, colleges and universities. And the notion is that there's something that they will get in, you know, what's seen by many, especially those who've gone to those schools, a very nurturing and empowering environment. And I remember when I was in school and thinking about college, one thought that I remember hearing, I didn't have a strong feeling either way, but one thing I remember hearing was that, you know, well, those institutions aren't really what the world looks like. And so going to a University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where I went to school, is actually perhaps better prep for the world, because the world is going to look like that. But yeah, it was hell at times being in that environment, given the dynamics. And but I think a lot of parents are enamored with the notion of sending their kids to HBCUs, because the thought is that that's a place where they will get they will be infused with confidence, with a sense of empowerment, even a sense of entitlement. Like, you know what, I can do this. I can go out here and conquer the world, because my years at Howard or at Hampton or many of the other dozens of other HBCUs that exist, I will be given armor to help me go out into this world. And maybe, yes, my campus isn't what the world looks like, but here's a place where I can get the things that I really need in order to survive out in that world. So, I have no doubt that there are parents out there. You know, we look back now on our decision about Brooks and we say, you know, we're really happy that this institution is here for her, and that when she goes there, she's got a lot of kids that look like her. She can feel safe, she can feel comfortable, and she can also know that we're, you know, that that school is one of the best schools in the city.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to tell you, and that the message I take from what you just said, and it goes back to what I had talked about. If you want to have integration in society, you have to be proactive. You just can't just say, we're going to have integration. There's so many forces that work against integration. There's so many mental, psychological forces in the minds of white people and the minds of black people. If you want to make integration work, you have to put some effort into it. This is my belief, Alden. You can't just say, oh, we're going to put all these kids in this school. And then, well, who could be in the smart kid class, the white kid or the black kid? Are you going to use the smart kid class as a way to tell white parents that it's, quote unquote, safe for their kid to go to school? And then you're going to tell all black parents, well, you kids belong in like the remedial classes. Yeah. You have to work at it. Maybe you have to hire counselors. Maybe you have to have kumbaya sessions and talk about things, you know?
I mean, to me, the benefit of an integrated school isn't just that, hey, we've got an integrated school, to, because even within that integrated, I mean, if you look at Chicago from a, from 30 miles above, right, we're an integrated city, right? We're 30%
I love
this
accent. 30% that. What is it? I mean, it reminds, it's like, if you, where does this accent come from? Is this like a... Richard Pryor doing a white guy. One time we had this thing, a tangent. We were doing a show at the Hideout, and Will Guzzardi was on the stage, his state rep. And oh my God, Alden, he was imitating his imitation of Bruce Rauner. And I looked at him, I go, that is Richard Pryor doing a white guy. Anyway, I'm sorry, man, but no, it's so okay. Funny. I love this image. usually I just go like that.
I forgot my train of thought now.
I can't remember what you're saying either. Oh, no, you were saying it was a good riff. You were saying that if you just look at the city of Chicago.
Yeah. I think the value of integration. So the value of integration isn't just to pat our backs on and say, hey, look, we've got integration. Because even in quote-unquote integrated spaces, you can find a lot of a lack of integration, you know, segregation and other issues. But if you've got people under the same roof, whether it's a school or some other setting, it's an opportunity to have the kind of dialogue that I think we ultimately really have to have in order to kind of make our way through things. People have to get an opportunity to know folks that they may not necessarily know very well, they may not interact with, they may have thoughts or stereotypical beliefs or what have you. And the only way to break those things down is to force people to say, okay, you may think something about John from Inglewood, but here John from Inglewood works beside you every day, and this is an opportunity for you to actually engage, mm-hmm. have dialogue, and for you to really kind of get an understanding of who John is and what makes him tick, for you to see in the ways in which you and John think very much alike, even though you may come from different worlds, and for you perhaps to have an understanding that there are 30,000 other people that look like John that live in Inglewood. And if you can be safe in your space with John at work, you can probably be safe in that space with 30,000 people who look like John and live beside him and go to the grocery store with him and everything else. I think oftentimes what people can be in those integrated spaces, and even if they have really good relationships with their with folks that they know, that they work with, that they go to school with, who come from different parts of the city or what have you, when they go back home and they think about the communities that those folks come from, mm-hmm. they divorce the individual from the community. Yeah. Well, John's okay.
Yeah.
But John's neighborhood might not necessarily be okay.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I worked with a guy, a really good guy, and we had a great relationship. And when he talked about communities on the South Side, he was very disparaging about those communities. And I didn't have the confidence in our relationship to call him out on it. But I thought to myself, dude, you call these crap communities. I live there.
Yeah.
Today, I grew up there. Yeah, there are struggles, but the community's not crap. You know, it's not a, you know, like Donald Trump caught hell for S-hole countries. I'm sorry, for shithole countries.
You can say it, man. It's a podcast.
He knew that Alden was a good guy, so on and so forth. When I left, he said glowing things about me leaving.
Friend, not Donald Trump.
Right, yes.
Yeah, okay,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
All right, just...
But he could not apparently... draw that same, he couldn't necessarily see the same qualities that he saw in me in the tens of thousands of people who lived in Auburn Gresham or who lived in Inglewood or West Inglewood or Washington Heights or other South Side communities. And I think that's the challenge. So even when we're together, there's still a lot of work that we have to do to kind of get over that hump, to get mm-hmm. over that mystery, to kind of break down those walls that, that subliminally we hear over and over again because we're watching the news or we're seeing this and all these other ways in which we're being told about particular communities, and we don't take advantage of people who are right in front of us who can tell us, you know, hey, or can invite us out or whatever the case might be. Let's break down those barriers. So when we have these spaces, I guess my point is, you know, that's an opportunity for us to take advantage of that. And we don't do that. We just stop and go, hey, look, we're doing great. We've got 30% here and 30% there. And I haven't seen the whole Oak Park series.
About Steve the James high school series.
And he's caught some, he's taken some heat about that also. But I thought it was fascinating a little bit that I did see where within this, you know, this seemingly ideal setting, that there was a lot of tension. And even with the best of intentions, there were, you know, African-American students still felt very marginalized. And there was disbelief and even kind of anger from not only the school's administration, but from the community as a whole. And I don't know if that was just because they didn't want to hear that, because that wasn't the picture that they had of their community and of that particular school. But there's a truth to the ways in which minority communities, and I'll say particularly African Americans, can be marginalized, is I guess the best way I can think of it in terms of describing that experience. Even when no one is, you know, kind of wearing a hood or doing something else very deliberately, from a standpoint of white supremacy or so on and so forth, this kind of stuff is just in our bones, you know, and it exudes even when we don't think, you know, when we're not being intentional about it. And so that's something that we have to be very honest about and talk about and accept, and then say, wow, okay, I didn't quite get this, and maybe now I'm starting to get it a little bit. For a moment, it seemed like we were getting into this, and I'm thinking of this because when I left MPC, we had just gone through a diversity, equity, and inclusion training among the staff, and had a few sessions where we had some very kind of eye-opening conversations. I got to WBEZ, and within a couple of months, we were doing the same thing there, and there's been a diversity committee that's been started, a DEI committee, I would say, And so there's still some conversations that are happening. We haven't had much activity since those sessions that I went to when I first got there. And what those things, it was the first time I've ever done anything like that. And from what I was hearing, that this is kind of like a thing now. A lot of workplaces are doing these kinds of conversations. But I thought it was incredibly valuable, incredibly uncomfortable, but incredibly valuable, because that was when the light bulb, at least for some folks, was kind of going off. And it was kind of like, well, I'm not doing anything or trying to do anything to make you feel uncomfortable. But what I don't know is that you come here, the sum total of all of your experiences, and as a person of color, you've been in many spaces where you've been in meetings and you want to perk up and say something, and a white man in the room cuts you off, and it's the seventh time that's happened in the 2 weeks that you've been at the job. Or it's a space where a conversation is happening about something of enormous kind of cultural value to you, and someone diminishes it as, you know, just some fad that's this or that, and so on and so forth. And it's like, okay, you come in here and then I do the same thing. I'm not trying to, you know, offend you or diminish you or say that you're not valuable. But what I don't understand is the ways in which that pain has been exacted upon you, you know, throughout your entire life. And what I also don't understand is I don't know the history. And I don't understand the fact that even though I may not intend to, that I have biases, that I come from a place of privilege. And so those are all things that are kind of, I mean, they like try to break it down to some very basic kinds of concepts. Yeah. And that's the kind of education that I think we need. It should be taught in schools and at a very early age.
That was my point. That's ultimately my point. It's not a goal. Nobody cares about it. Yeah. They do these things at work now because they didn't do them when those guys who are at work now were in kindergarten, because they didn't think it was important, because it really isn't important. You're not going to not get into Harvard because your ability, you listen to a black guy when he talks. You understand? Not something. I'm quoting you to you. It's not something people see as a problem, Ben. I'm like, oh yeah, the light went on. Yeah. And I got to tell you though, a funny little thing. Oh, Is that my phone?
That's my phone.
Oh, your phone.
Sorry.
Man, you got a loud phone. We had one of those at the Reader. We had one of these diversity training sessions. Uh-huh. And so we were into diversity training sessions. They break you up into groups. And I don't know if they did it. Your diversity training session was this way, but they like at some point you just pair off with, there's two people. Mm-hmm. And so the leader, the facilitator, isn't that what they call them? The facilitator, yeah, says, so tell the person that you're with, like a story about the first time you became aware of race. I think that's what it was. So I'm leaving all names out of this one. So we're doing this exercise and, you know, so I turn to the person that I'm doing the exercise with, just this random person that they chose, and they go, well, the first time I became aware of race was blah, 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 blah. Right in the middle of me telling this person my heartfelt story, this person goes, yawns. I'm like, that is like flunking diversity training, all right? That's supposed to yawn at me when I'm telling my heart. It's like, oh, my God. It's like diversity training 101. Don't yawn at someone when they're pretty, whatever, anyway. But I hear what you're saying. I'm glad they did the diversity training. I think we should do more diversity training. But my point was, if we saw it as a goal, if we really believe in diversity training, if we really believe that we should have a country where everybody is equal and we're all represented, listen to what other people, we're in zone with other people, we would start a lot earlier than we're like, you're 40 or whatever. You got what I'm saying?
Yeah.
NPR, it's time to do diversity training. Why don't we do it back when we're five?
Was that your voice?
Yeah, that was, I don't know. I do so many voices all that I don't even know. I'm schizophrenic. I was just talking to this guy. It's a fascinating book. Have you read this? It's Carlo Rotello.
I have it, and I'm dying to open it up. I just haven't at the time.
Well, he was just sitting in that chair where you were sitting.
Said,
I know. It's a small world. The world is always coming to an end. He was sitting there, and he's a white guy. He grew up in South Shore, okay. And listening to you just now, I went back to my conversation with him and having read the book, and you were talking about how, you know, people will say, oh, you're a good guy, Alden, but that neighborhood is a crummy neighborhood that you're from. And Carlo Rotello was talking about a time when his family grew up, when he was growing up as a kid in South Shore in the 70s, mm-hmm. and he viewed it as a stable middle-class community. He was one of the few white families in South Shore at the time, but he viewed it like, this is a middle-class community. Yeah. It's the heart and soul of middle-class Chicago. Yeah. I can tell you right now, Alden, that if you ask most white people in the city of Chicago or the suburbs, is South Shore a stable middle-class community? If you ask them that in the 1970s and 1980s, they'd say, hell no. Yeah. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it's just funny because in his view...
And because he's right. I mean, Ashburn is the community that comes to mind immediately as a very kind of modern example of this. Now, Ashburn, I grew up... my mom left LeClaire Courts when I was about 3 years old. We moved to 78th and Winchester in Auburn Gresham. And Ashburn was the community immediately to the west. And at that time, Ashburn was mostly white. It was, I mean, probably 80-some-odd% white. And it gradually became more and more African-American. And then in later years, particularly the western half of Ashburn has become mostly Latino. I want to say there's like a sliver or corner of the community that is still white, but I think the percentage of white residents in Ashburn is less than 10%.
Where is Ashburn now?
Ashburn is essentially, I think, western from 79th to 87th, mm-hmm. I believe, all the way over to Cicero, I believe, wherever the city border. That may be a little off. It might be 75th. I can't recall exactly.
Western's the eastern edge, then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the boundary may technically be the Penn Central Railroad tracks, like between Oakley and Bell or something like that. But anyway, so that community in the 90s started to turn African-American, and then in the 2000s, like I said, the other half of it, Latino. And so the white population essentially left and was not replaced by other white residents. But that community, the black folks that were moving to Ashburn in the 80s and 90s were solid middle class African-Americans. And as far as I know, it's still a fairly solid middle-class community, even though it is now an African-American and Latino community. It's still solidly middle-class. A lot of homes, some rental, but not a terrible amount of rental. The community that doesn't have the kind of luster that I think that it had, at least in my eyes as a kid, I thought of that as like, you know, like the sun seemed to shine better when I went to into Ashburn from Auburn Gresham. But you know, a lot of those first wave of people of color that come into white communities are people of color who are literally of the same economic means. And so if there are white folks in those situations who fear those folks, they should have an understanding that those folks probably have more in common with them, particularly economically, than they do from the spaces from which they came. And so I think that's something that people don't quite realize, that it makes all of this thing even more of a travesty.
Yeah, and so when you think about terms of what a government can do, do you have anything pops in your mind? I know you're in the business as a journalist. You edit stories now, but you're also a person who raised in the city of Chicago. You live in the city of Chicago. You raised your kids in the city of Chicago. So we have a new mayor. We have the old mayor has left the building.
Can we still talk about the old mayor?
I could talk about him all day if I want.
Because I think there's still a lot more to say about.
Well,
take a chill pill, man.
Yeah. yes, my old friend, Rom. Well, I'll just speak for my, you know, Mick Dumke, our mutual friend, has mildly chastised me because he points out to me, Alden, that as a columnist, I'm in a host of a podcast, I'm free to vent my opinions. And many of the people coming to my studio are journalists. Like, I'm still a journalist, too. Let me admit that. They're reporters, beat reporters, and they're not allowed to say whatever they feel.
Yeah.
So I try to be respectful since Mick mildly chastised me on that point. At the same time, I really struggle with this because I believe that Rahm Emanuel is a complete and utter disaster from almost every single aspect as mayor of the city of Chicago in any way, shape, or form when you take a look at our challenges as a city. And you can name any issue, and I can make an argument that we are in worse off shape now than we were when he came in. And it's not something I hold against the guy. I don't know the guy. Mm-hmm. For all I know, he's a wonderful human being. Do you follow? I'm just talking about how he's run the city. So yeah, you're absolutely correct. I think it's like post-traumatic stress disorder. This dude was a lunatic. All right. It was all about branding him, and he ran the city that way. And so we're dealing with these issues of race. And from the get-go, when he closed those mental health clinics, it's like, what? I still can't even get the words out, Alden. I feel that he it was almost as though he wanted black people to move out of the city of Chicago. He almost like he either that or he was just so willfully indifferent to the consequences of his decisions as the chief executive officer that he didn't realize it was. So I don't know which is worse, you know.
Yeah, to the point, I think, and this is where you started, and I might have kind of drifted off a little bit, but around the loss of African American population not being seen as a problem.
The Alden Lowry statement, yes.
I have no idea what was going on in the mayor's head, you know, so I can't say that, you know, he didn't care or what have you. But I certainly thought that, particularly when it seemed, I mean, he came into office a year after, or right around the time he came into office, there was all of this press about the fact that the black population had fallen in Chicago from 2000 to 2010 by 180,000. So in my mind, even from the day he took office, or very soon after he took office, this was something that people were talking about. And a light bulb should have gone off that said, hey, look, something's wrong. You know, Chicago was losing population, black population, at the same clip, or very near the same clip, that Detroit was. And the problems that were inherent in Detroit, I think, were plainly clear and were talked about. The city was near bankruptcy and so on and so forth. So to me, even without the continuing loss, there should have been something that put that on the radar screen for the city's leader that this was an issue. And I don't know why it never seemed to become that for him or for his administration. And maybe there were people within the administration who were saying, Mr. Mayor, we got to do something about this. You know, these communities are emptying out. They're hollowing out. That's going to cause problems for us in terms of perhaps from a safety perspective, perhaps from the public schools perspective. The population was already kind of declining in CPS during the decade before he got into office. So this certainly should have been something that was on his radar screen. We don't know exactly what was being said within City Hall, but certainly from a policy perspective, the city did basically nothing to directly address this. To the mayor's credit, there were some things that he did to try to help with economic development, to try to help with some other things. I'm just
name
trying
two.
To be I'm trying to offer some balance.
Well,
the neighborhood opportunity bonus was something that he threw out a lot.
All right, that's one.
You know,
I'll point out it was a sliver of the millions that he developed. So yes. They threw a crumb.
Yeah,
here you go.
You're absolutely
just throwing that out
you're
there.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. It's hard to name one.
There were some other things that that the administration did. I can remember one of the deputy mayor, Bob Rivkin, who took me to task in an email when I was at NPC and writing about the decline of the black population and so on and so forth. And, you know, he wrote a long email telling me all of the great things that that the mayor had done with regard to South and West Side communities. So it was a list. You know, I could quibble with a lot of what he put in the list, but they at least had a list. So, and if no one else, the mayor and his closest advisors.
Well, it's nice they had a list.
He'd done a number of things.
Okay.
So
it's good to know.
But yes, this certainly from the moment he came into office, this should have been something that was seen as a red flag, and I don't know why it wasn't. My guess would be that, you know, Rahm had a lot of ignorance about what was happening in those communities, even when times were better, and certainly as things were struggling. I just think it was a severe blind spot for him.
I was looking ahead, not back, but you were the one. Let's just set the record straight. All there was is said, go back and look back. I remember when Rahm first ran, and it was 2011, I want to say.
Yeah.
There was a debate, and they were talking about schools. And I'm doing this off the top of my mind. I'm paraphrasing. Go back to what you just said about your friend who said, oh, I love Alden, but the neighborhood he comes from is crummy.
Yeah.
Rahm got up there and said, and I'm paraphrasing, there's like about three good schools in the city of Chicago. And one of them is Walter Payton, and the other one is Northside Prep. And then there's some charters, and all the rest of them are bad. I'm paraphrasing.
Wow.
That showed, I'll send you the articles. I was sat there, my jaw dropped.
Wow.
Astounding ignorance about the public schools of Chicago. Just the characterization, the word like good versus bad. What does that mean? And the notion that there was just like one or two good schools, we'd be like Payton. I think he had Northside Prep on there. He may not even have been aware of Young's prominence. You know what I'm saying? It shows such a level of ignorance about the public schools of Chicago. Like, he didn't even take the time to study a book on it, or you'll read a manual or something, an article on it. You know, like the top five scoring schools in the city of Chicago are all public schools. Charter schools aren't even in the top 10. You know what I'm saying?
The city, I think, did a disservice by not. I mean, he made mention on the Charlie Rose show, like in March or April, that, you know, mayor of Chicago was a job that in 2010, that was something that he had always kind of envisioned or dreamed about. Like, if he had a dream job, and he descended upon us in Chicago in October of 2010 after he'd left the White House, and the field literally, particularly among the white political establishment in Chicago, just cleared the field for him. And he, you know, he kind of, I mean, he had, you know, Chico gave him, Gary Chico gave him a little bit of a run. I can't remember, but it was another prominent, maybe Miguel Duvalier.
Miguel Duvalier
was in
now
that
our
race.
School board chair.
Yes,
president
so
of our school board.
He's back in business. So, but it, he never really got to face, I think, the kind of gauntlet that he should have to say, okay, well, tell us why you're the right person. We know you're a big wig within the Democratic Party. We know you've worked for two presidents, but can you be mayor of Chicago? And you haven't, I mean, there was a question about whether he was even a resident, right? He never faced the kinds of scrutiny that I think he really needed to for people to really kind of make an issue of how much he didn't know. And I think the 8 years after that, there were a lot of times when, you know, that ignorance, you know, really kind of became apparent.
You know what they call that? Reverse affirmative action. Think about that one for a while, okay? Imagine one black guy in the world. Just, you're going to get to be the mayor, you know?
I don't even know if you call it reverse, but I think you just call it affirmative. Just life. This is just how it's been.
You know? You don't know anything about Chicago? You don't live in Chicago? You never really lived in here? Hey, why don't you become our mayor? Well, sounds good to me. I'm a Chicago voter. That's my Chicago voter accent.
Good.
Kind of like befuddled. It's scratching my head. Rahm, didn't he work for Barack Obama? How many times did I hear that from Chicago? Benny worked for Barack Obama. Oh, well, let's make him president, okay? All right, so
stay tuned.
It's true. Although, I don't know. Now he's going to work for some, what do you call it, D? Boutique or boutique? Which one is it?
I think boutique.
Boutique,
right?
A boutique investment firm. Not just any old investment firm, a boutique investment. I'm like, when I saw that in the paper, what's the difference between a boutique investment firm and an investment firm?
I don't know. Don't think, I guess it's just like, so when he makes his next sets of millions of dollars, he can say, you know, I did it in a very kind of new and interesting and unique kind of way, you know. I don't know.
I don't
take a
chill
pill, man.
Okay, sorry, Rahm, I forgot. All right, so looking forward, what kind of policies do you think Lori Lightfoot, who, I hate to say this, you know, I mean, I'm really encouraged by the early, I'm just put it out there, I'm very encouraged by the first month of Lori Lightfoot's campaign. I'm usually the naysayer, all the one who goes, oh God, this is wretched.
Yeah.
But touch wood, I mean, fingers crossed.
She's certainly made an impression. I just have to say, I think it was so incredibly cool that when she was kind of dressing down Ed Burke, and I think her words were, she was talking about the games that he was playing and so on and so forth, and she was like, I'm not having it. I'm like, when have I heard a mayor of Chicago say, I'm not having it? No,
she
scored points for me with that. But no, I mean, on a number of fronts, you know, she's, I would say, kind of hitting on the right kinds of things. She's come out and she's talked about how equity is going to be, you know, a big part of the kind of work or the way she views that office, very differently from Rahm. We were talking about how when he came into office, perhaps he should have barely been cognizant to that. She's also talked about the black population loss is a thing that needs to be addressed. Now, there's a question of actually what she actually does about that. But she is at least on the record saying that this is something that that needs some attention. So she created the Office of Equity. She's talked about policy through a racial lens. She's seems to be much more kind of open and direct about the need for affordable housing. And she made a pick for the housing. She brought Rahm had put money in the budget to bring back the housing department, and so Mayor Lightfoot actually is bringing it back. I picked a former colleague of mine who I think is one of the best minds around housing and affordable housing in the city, Marisa Navarro. I think that was a big plus. And then she's really going strong on ethics and going strong and pushing back against some of the Chicago way provisions of the way the city council has worked. I know Ed Burke was already down on one knee from all of the trouble that he's having, but man, she was not shy about, you know, kind of trying to deliver the knockout blow. So I think those are all very good things. And from that standpoint, a lot of the things that we've complained about with Emmanuel and with Daley, I think those blind spots don't exist with her, but she may have some other blind spots where she may need some care and direction and guidance. And my hope is that she will be open enough to hear people and to change course if she's got folks telling her, you know, Mayor Lightfoot, we appreciate what you've done, but here's something where we think you need some growth. And you know, the No Cop Academy, I want to say there's a couple of other things that during the campaign were red flags for people. They were kind of like, you know, I don't think she's kind of strong enough on this point that we'd like her to be, even though she's, I think, did a commendable job in leading the Police Accountability Task Force during her time as the chair of the police board. There were some cases where folks thought she, you know, was she actually voted to retain officers even when the superintendent was calling for their for the officer's departure. And that was a red flag for a number of folks in the police accountability reform space. But if she is backing this GAPA plan, which I think is revolutionary. I mean, it's, you know, GAPA is calling for some very strong changes to the ways in which police are
GAPA held. Is an acronym for, can I do this?
I can't. That's why I just said GAPA.
GAPA. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But it has to do with policing policies in the city.
Right.
Of Chicago.
And some very, their reform ideas are very strong. So her picks for the school board, I think was also a sign that she doesn't have the same blind spots. You know, ROM's police CPS board was largely kind of like a corporate who's who. And Mayor Lightfoot has chosen, my wife who works for CPS was like, she's never known the school board to have like parents. And
I mean, but, Chicago public school parents.
Right,
yeah, right,
exactly.
Right.
You know, yeah. Oh, yes. Thank you for that. It's a clear distinction. Yes. So on many of these issues that we've had a deficit from our city leadership for many years, Mayor Lightfoot is a breath of fresh air. But yeah, like I said, there's still some things, you know, so that, you know, on Lincoln Yards, there were, you know, she wasn't, I think, as forceful as some really wanted her to be, the TIF issues. And, you know, those may be the challenges that she has, because I think she will inherently see the benefit of those kinds of developments. And the challenge will be, how do I balance the fact that I want this multi-million dollar or the benefits of the economic, potential economic benefits to the city for this to happen? And in order to get these folks to say, I'm coming to Chicago instead of going to Dallas or Houston or some of these other cities that are seen as growing cities, Atlanta is another one. How do I keep them interested but still meet the needs of the very diverse needs of my municipality and the residents here? And oftentimes that's a balance where it's like, you're trying to figure out what's that sweet spot, and sometimes it may be so thin that you can overshoot. And you're like, okay, all right. Okay, so we're giving $2 billion or whatever it is to these the 78 in Lincoln Yards, and we're getting all this development, and we only got 600 units or however many units of affordable housing out of it. But, you know, from my, you know, from their calculus, that was the sweet spot. That was where I could get yeses on both ends, and they may miscalculate. And it's like, well, yes, it's a yes for the folks developing Lincoln Yards in 78. But for people who are really in need of affordable housing, who want to be in communities like that, it's like, you know, we need 6,000 units of affordable housing in that place, not 600.
Well, we'll close with this, because you were on a roll. You're trying to be as optimistic as you could, and then you suddenly remembered Lincoln Yards, and you headed off. I'm like, don't go there, Alden. We're trying to end on an optimistic note, because the point of every conversation that you and I have had on this issue has always come down to the policies implemented by the city of Chicago undercut sort of the overall goals, the ideals that we have. So Mayor Rahm would always talk about how he wanted Chicago. You give these speeches, it's a tale of two cities, and Roseland's not as good as Ravenswood, and I want a city where Roseland's as good as Ravenswood. And then he would implement a policy that would act to the exact opposite, and then he would get some guy in City Hall to write a letter, you know, culling through the press releases to cherry pick points to shut all that up with, you know. And so I'm hoping that we move away from the rhetoric of ideals that are not reflected by the programs, and go more to the programs. Do you follow what I'm saying? policies that you could realistically say will result in an ideal, as opposed to just like a word of ideals with policies that work against that? How about that as a goal to start off with?
I think that would be a goal to shoot for. Yes, we should be. I mean, at the end of the day, it's our we got to be judged on what we actually enact and not what we say is important. But I often think when people are judged in positions like that, that's where people set their opinion. You said something very interesting about Rahm kind of being for Rahm, you know, kind of his time as mayor was spent, and I'm maybe embellishing a little bit from what you were saying, but what I thought I heard you say was that he was really about kind of promoting himself and so on and so forth. And in the closing months of his time in office, that seemed very apparent to me anyway. And to some degree, anybody who's finishing up their time wants to try to get things done and so on and so forth, their legacy and all of that. Yeah, I get that. But he was, in the ways in which he talked about some of the things that were going on, I think he was leaving out a lot where it was like, okay, yeah, you've done this, but what about...
I'll go. I'm going to just take a break. Our good friend Mick Dumke again challenged me. Who is worse, Ben, in your opinion, Mayor Rahm or Mayor Daley? And so I dedicated a column to this.
Oh, wow.
And I ultimately decided that Mayor Rahm was worse than Mayor Daley. And the tiebreaker was that Rahm was insufferable in his last few months in office, where he was going around promoting everything he did, completely rewriting everything he had done, not an honest bone in his body in assessing what he did, the challenges he faced, whereas Daley was relatively benevolent. Once he decided he wasn't going to run, he left the scene. It was like Elvis has left the building. Yeah. And he even put in I forget the dude's name, the guy to run the Board of Education, because he didn't want... It was some guy from Civic Chicago, Philanthropic Chicago, Terry something. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Oh, Mazzani.
Yeah, Terry Mazzani. Mm-hmm. He put him in. You know what? I don't want the next mayor to be burdened with...
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and he put Mazzani in, and I'm backing out. He basically backed out and got out, and like he knew... He was the man, Daley, that ran the city for... He didn't have to go around proving it. Rahm was running around to the very end. My legacy. Yeah. So anyway, you know, it's hard for me not to talk about Rahm, because you're right. I still... The traumatic stress is still... Anyway, Alden Lowry, it's a blast talking to you. This may have been my most favorite of all the conversations we had. This one was a lot of fun.
Yeah, because we got to curse.
Let the record show that Alden was the only one to curse during this interview. I refrain. But I will just, since you said it, I said, yeah, the shithole countries. That was the quote from our illustrious president. Anyway, thanks so much, Alden, and best of luck to you at BEZ, and hope you guys continue to conquer the world there journalistically. All right,
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. It's always fun to talk, and I'm glad we brought the band back together again.
Yeah, the band is back together, ladies and gentlemen. The band is back together. This is a special bonus issue of the band or the Ben Jarofsky Show. Take care, everybody. See you Tuesday.